and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News, reporting via remote. I'm Jeff Custer. While both Russia and Ukraine say Russia controls 80% of the key eastern city of Severodonetsk, a Ukrainian regional governor says Ukraine continues to fight in the city and its fighters control the industrial areas. Luhansk regional leader says Russian forces have destroyed all three bridges leading out of the city, but Ukrainian forces were still trying to evacuate the wounded. He says a mass evacuation of civilians is not possible due to the relentless shelling and fighting in the city. A Russian general says a humanitarian corridor will be opened Wednesday to evacuate civilians from the besieged Azot chemical plant in the city, but those civilians would be taken to Russian-held territory. About 12,000 people remain in Severodonetsk, a city with a pre-war population of about 100,000. While the war in Ukraine is not even remotely funny, Ukrainians are learning to laugh about it. Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
It's a way to cope with the trauma. Anton Timochenko's stand-up routine in Kyiv uses a lot of war-related material.
That is a very cheap psychotherapy. You just yield like $8, $10, that's the price of the ticket, and you're laughing like an hour.
Timochenko realizes war jokes are a good way to save your mental health, but it can get stale.
People are a little bit tired about the same themes all the time because Russians are stupid, and it's not like a new idea.
Yulia Shaitko in the audience said she just needed to laugh.
Thanks to them, we actually can gather together and, you know, experience and enjoy it together.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and his troops, especially dead and wounded ones, are favorite targets of dark Ukrainian war. Wartime humor. There are no jokes about Ukrainian war dead. I'm Ed Donahue.
This is VOA News. Speaking at the Austrian Summit Climate Conference Tuesday, United Nations Secretary of General Antonio Guterres said the world's richest countries should be building towards a clean energy future and not doubling down on fossil fuels.
New funding for fossil fuel exploration and production infrastructure is delusional. It will only further feed the scourge of war, pollution, and climate catastrophe. I repeat my call for G20 government to dismantle coal infrastructure with a full phase out by 2030 for OECD countries and for all others.
The UN chief said the energy and climate crisis has been exacerbated by the war in Ukraine, and the world has seen a perilous doubling down on fossil fuels by major economies, opening new areas for drilling and development. The International Energy Agency has called for an end to new oil, gas, and coal projects in order to meet global climate changes, and says renewable energy investments must triple by 2030. Guterres called on financial actors to fund renewable energy. The U.S. House of Representatives panel investigating last year's January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol announced Tuesday it has postponed Wednesday's scheduled hearing. At a news conference Tuesday, committee member California Congressman Pete Aguiar gave no reason for the postponement, but said the panel will still hold its Thursday planned hearing as scheduled. The Monday's hearing featured videotaped testimony from former U.S. Attorney General William Barr, among other White House and political aides to then-President Donald Trump, who said they had repeatedly told the former president that his allegations of fraud in the 2020 election were baseless and that he had lost re-election. Barr said many of Trump's claims of election irregularities were completely bogus and silly, recalling one of his several White House meetings with Trump before Barr himself resigned in 2020. Meanwhile, an eight-day trucker strike in South Korea ended Tuesday after negotiators and the union reached agreements to extend pay guarantees. News reports indicate the strike had local economic impacts in South Korea, but had not yet spread globally. The strike did cripple ports and industrial hubs in the country, causing more than $1.2 trillion in lost output through delayed shipments from autos to petrochemicals and spirits, according to the Ministry of Trade and Industry. The relatively quick resolution of the strike appears to have avoided potential havoc that raised concerns among small businesses. Repeating the hour's top news story, while both Russia and Ukraine say Russia now controls 80% of the key eastern city of Severodonetsk, a Ukrainian regional governor says the Ukrainians continue to fight for the city. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We don't have a clear idea of the participants. Obviously, to achieve a sustainable and comprehensive peace, that would need the representation from other actors in the conflict.
That's William Davison with the International Crisis Group on Ethiopia's creation of a committee to negotiate peace in Tigray. Details coming up. Also, Guinea's public prosecutor has charged a military police officer with the slaying of a student. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Britain's first scheduled flight taking asylum seekers to Rwanda was due to depart today, with the government warning anyone who avoided it through last-minute legal challenges would be put on a later flight despite the outcry from critics. To brief us on the matter, we have standing by in London our reporter for the Swahili service, Venust Simimana. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Venust.
Thank you for having me, Yehiyas.
So, what is the latest on this notices of deportation?
The latest we have now is that seven people are expected to be on the flight leaving London this evening for Kigali. At least four appeals against the removal were heard this afternoon, and they were unsuccessful. So, as you see, from 37 people expected to be part of the first one-way trip to the East African country, the number has dropped to seven due to many legal challenges. So the plane will be taking off from a military base this evening. It is a private chartered plane costing more than $500,000. As you might know, the legal challenges that we see today were expected by the champion, of course, of this plan, who is the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Foreign Home Affairs, Priti Patel, but also by the Prime Minister himself, Boris Johnson, who told the minister today, a cabinet minister, that he knew that the scheme would be met with plenty of legal challenges.
But Venust, you know, the plan horrified a lot of political opponents. The United Nations refugee chief called it catastrophic, and the entire leadership of the Church of England denounced it as immoral policy that shames Britain. But the government says the deportation strategy is needed to stem the flow of migrants risking their lives in channel crossings and, in some cases, smash the people smuggling networks. Does the government have a point there?
They might have a point. They are defending their policy, as you said rightly. The plan to move asylum seekers to Rwanda has drawn a lot of criticism from day one. Human organizations, human rights campaigns, church leaders, as you say, they all condemned the move. But the Prime Minister is adamant. The government is going to get on and deliver, he told the cabinet minister today. The Archbishop of Canterbury described this move as ungodly. Prince Charles, who is next to the throne, said that it was appalling, and he will be in Rwanda in a week time to attend the Commonwealth head of government meeting in Kigali. So the government wanted to stop what's calling dangerous and illegal cross-channel migration. That is the policy, and this is what the Prime Minister Boris Johnson is defending.
So what is the general mood in the United Kingdom? What are people saying about this whole thing?
What do people say is when you look at and when you go to the street of London here and you talk to people, there is a divide in what people say about this policy. There was a kind of opinion poll that was carried out yesterday, and it shows that 44% backed the policy, with 40% against it, and among the 40, there are 27 who strongly oppose it. And as you know, this country has a culture of welcoming refugees. We have seen this in the past few months when they welcomed the refugees from Ukraine. And they don't understand what is happening. That's why there are a lot of questions in the parliament. There are a lot of questions in the constituencies, questioning MPs on why they are sending those people in Rwanda. And some of them are trying to commit suicide. Some of them have gone on hunger strike. They don't want to go to Rwanda. And some of them saying that they would rather prefer to go back to where they came from rather than going to Rwanda. But I must say that the government of Rwanda has said that if they came there, they will be treated with respect and dignity.
Reporter Venust Shimimana, VOA Central Africa Service in London. Thank you for your input.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has announced the formation of a committee to begin peace talks with Tigray forces after 18 months of war. Henry Wilkins reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed spoke to Parliament on Tuesday about the conflict in comments broadcast on state television. He said we need to repeat the victory that we made on the battlefield in peace talks. He added that the war is hindering the country's development, adding that every bullet that is shot is like a dollar lost. He said that the committee would be led by Deputy Prime Minister Demeke Mekonnen and would be given 10 to 15 days to decide what will be up for negotiation. Although the talks may have potential to bring an end to Ethiopia's civil war, William Davidson, an analyst with the International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based non-profit research group, told VOA that important details are yet to emerge.
We don't have a clear idea of the participants. Obviously, to achieve a sustainable and comprehensive peace, that would need the representation from other actors in the conflict.
The return to Tigray forces, TPLF, of the disputed region of West Tigray, which was occupied by Amhara and national forces in the recent conflict, is likely to be a major sticking point in peace talks. Last week, TPLF spokesperson Getachew Reda denied claims that the TPLF has abandoned claims to West Tigray. The conflict in Tigray began in late 2020 between the Ethiopian federal government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. It exploded into a civil war that has forced 2 million people from their homes. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
A UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Eritrea has issued a report critical of the deteriorating situation there, noting forced military conscription, arbitrary arrest, disappearances and torture. The report has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Special Rapporteur Mohamed Abdelsalam Babaker says Eritrea's involvement in the armed conflict in neighboring Ethiopia shines a light on the impact of the Eritrean government system of indefinite national military service. He describes the rights situation as dire. Those who attempt to evade the draft, he says, are imprisoned in inhumane and degrading conditions for indefinite periods of time.
The authorities also punish draft evaders by proxy, for example, by imprisoning a parent or a spouse in order to force them to surrender themselves. I also received reports about the conscripts who were killed as they tried to escape from Tigray or from military training centers in Eritrea.
Ethiopia's military offensive against the Tigray People's Liberation Front began November 4, 2020. Since then, thousands of Eritrean conscripts have been forced to participate in the conflict. Investigator Babiker says children as young as 14 have been rounded up and recruited, and that Eritrean refugees in Ethiopian camps have been kidnapped and forced to fight. He says the human rights situation in Eritrea continues to push thousands to flee to other countries for asylum.
I remain gravely concerned by the situation of hundreds of Eritreans who have been disappeared and arbitrarily detained in secret prisons in violation of human rights standards. I continue to hear testimonies from witnesses and victims who were held and tortured in places known as villas. These are actually secret places of detention that cannot be readily identified.
Tesfame Kiel-Geratu is an ambassador in Eritrea's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The ambassador said he would not respond to the outrageous allegations in the report as they were based on information from select and irresponsible sources. He added there was no human rights crisis in Eritrea and the harassment and sanctions imposed on his country had to stop. Eritrea was re-elected to serve as a member of the UN Human Rights Council in October 2021. Special Rapporteur Babiker says Eritrea's failure to promote and protect human rights puts the credibility and integrity of the Council in jeopardy. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's biggest opposition party is going to court to try to end one of the most controversial policies of the African National Congress government. The ANC introduced what it called cadre deployment in 1997, 3 years after it won the country's first democratic elections and under the leadership of President Nelson Mandela. In terms of cadre deployment, ANC membership and loyalty determines who gets top positions in the civil service, not merit. Darren Taylor reports.
The Democratic Alliance, the DA, says ending the policy would be another severe blow to the ANC's fading hopes of winning the next election in 2024.
Cadre deployment is fundamental to the decline of service delivery as well as the increase in corruption and ultimately state capture that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Dr. Leon Schreiber is the DA parliamentarian who filed the application, asking a judge to declare cadre deployment unlawful and unconstitutional. He points out that many of those accused of participating in former President Jacob Zuma's alleged state capture scheme, during which billions of dollars were stolen from state-owned enterprises, were in their positions of power simply because they were ANC loyalists.
The problem with cadre deployment is that it extends political power and the political authority of the ANC into the administrations.
Schreiber explains that the DA's court case isn't targeting ANC politicians, such as ministers and city councillors, because they're elected by voters.
What is affected by this case are government departments, municipal administrations, state-owned enterprises, every part of the public administration that is supposed to be non-political, independent and professional. It's there where cadre deployment has wreaked this havoc.
The ANC says it'll fight the DA's court motion. The ruling party insists cadre deployment is essential because it says ANC loyalists are best placed to implement its mission of what it calls the National Democratic Revolution. The ANC says giving more black people economic power is an effort that cannot be fulfilled only by politicians, but must be carried out across all spheres of society by people who are in tune with the party's philosophies. But Schreiber describes cadre deployment as cancerous.
It is the practice of weighing political loyalty as the decisive criteria for appointment rather than merit and competence. We believe that whenever political loyalty or whether people are members or cadres of a particular political party is the decisive factor, then you politicize the public service and you turn it into a part of a factional and political game, as we've seen indeed.
The ANC says that's exactly what the DA has done when it has demanded that people who subscribe to its values be appointed to posts in municipalities that the DA controls. Schreiber denies that his party uses anything resembling cadre deployment, saying the DA always strives to appoint the most qualified officials, regardless of their politics. In any case, says Schreiber, in condemning the DA for supposedly only appointing people inclined to support it, the ANC is, in effect, condemning itself. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Guinea's public prosecutor has charged a military police officer with the slaying of a student and four other police with failure to act. The public prosecutor's office identified the victim as 20-year-old student Thierno Mamadou Diallo. According to Reuters, he was shot dead by security forces during a protest over fuel price hikes in the capital Conakry on June 1st. The protest was the most serious unrest in the West African country since a military junta took power last year, ousting former President Alpha Condé. The junta, led by Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya, banned all public demonstrations in May after facing criticism for its proposed 36-month transition to elections. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. A Zimbabwean freelance journalist was convicted today of breaching immigration laws by helping two New York Times journalists enter the country illegally. Reporter Kudzanai Musenge sent us the following report.
Regional Magistrate Mark Nzira said he was satisfied that the prosecution proved its case against Jeffrey Moyo, who was accused of forging accreditation cards for the two foreign journalists. The magistrate fined Moyo 200,000 Zimbabwe dollars, about $615 US, at the official central bank exchange rate, or 6 months imprisonment if he fails to pay. He also was sentenced to 24 months in jail, which was suspended on condition that he does not commit a similar offense within 5 years. The magistrate said moral blame was high, as Moyo had connived to help the two journalists enter the country illegally, adding that doing so endangered national security, as the two could have been saboteurs. Moyo was arrested in May 2021 for helping Christina Goldbaum, an American, and Joao Silva from South Africa, who were deported 4 days after they arrived. Moyo's lead counsel, prominent human rights lawyer Beatrice Mtetwa, told VOA that the judgment and punishment would be appealed.
200,000 is the maximum amount allowed in terms of that section of the Immigration Act. We do not believe that the highest fine was justified on the facts. We believe we have very good prospects of success on appeal because the judgment was not really based on the evidence led. There's a lot of surmise and conjecture in the judgment, so we will be appealing both conviction and sentence.
Moyo told VOA he was relieved that he has not been jailed, but said he wants to have his conviction quashed through the appeal.
I'm happy. I was afraid to go back to jail. It's not a good place. I would want my image to be cleared. My lawyers know that I'm not guilty of any offense. I approached the ZMC to get accreditation for my colleagues, and I committed no offense. I hope I'm going to be cleared completely.
Moyo's case grabbed international attention after he was detained for over 3 weeks before bail was granted. His co-defendant, Tabang Manika, a senior employee of the Zimbabwe Media Commission, or ZMC, was acquitted in a separate trial on charges of helping the journalists. The ZMC is a statutory body that accredits all journalists in the country. In a statement after the arrest of the two, the New York Times said it was deeply troubled over Moyo's prosecution, which it said appeared designed to suppress press freedom in Zimbabwe. The New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists is among several groups that also condemned Moyo's arrest, calling it an example of the continued harassment of journalists in the country. Reporting for VOA from Lawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
In Cameroon, hundreds of people have protested attacks on schools, churches, and clinics in the country's troubled west after a hospital in the city of Mamfi was torched. Cameroon's military and separatists traded blame for last week's attack, and Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
Cameroonian officials say several hundred people protested on the streets of Mamfi city on Monday against separatist attacks on civilian bodies in the southwest area. Cameroon's state broadcaster CRTV reported the protest was organized by community leaders after the largest hospital in Mamfi was torched on June 8. Merchant Daniel Mbange spoke to VOA from Mamfi via a messaging application on why he took part in the protest.
It is very, very disheartening that people will attack a social infrastructure which has brought use for the entire community. Who on earth will think of destroying a hospital where women and children, men, the elderly, use it?
Similar protests have been taking place in other towns, including Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The military blames rebels for the attack and says its troops rescued about 50 patients from flames that injured several patients and nurses. Capo Daniel is a self-declared deputy defense chief of the Ambazonia Defense Forces, one of Cameroon's largest rebel groups. He denies they were responsible and voiced a common separatist claim that government troops carried out the attack to tarnish their image.
There is a Cameroon military barracks not far from there. There was a joint Cameroon military patrol and checkpoint close by. Ambazonian fighters could not have been able to bypass these military installations, take the time to remove patients while shooting in the air without any intervention of the Cameroon military. It was an action carried out by Cameroon military men dressed in civilian clothing.
Cameroonian officials rejected the rebels' claim. Mengot Victor Arenkongo is a Cameroonian minister in charge of special duties in Yaoundé.
Today, we hear them on social media accusing our defense and security forces. They no longer want to own what their products have committed. A hospital that had about 49 patients and nurses. These are witnesses. They know who took them out of the beds. They were not military people. They took the patients out of the beds after the war before setting the hospital on fire.
Nkongo says federal troops rushed to the hospital and relocated patients to a nearby military hospital. The protesters Monday called on the government and military to better protect hospitals, schools, and churches from separatist attacks. Last week's attack is not the first time Anglophone separatists have been accused of targeting civilian buildings in Mamfi. In February, the Roman Catholic Church in Cameroon said armed men torched a renowned girls' dormitory in the city. The military blamed rebels who vowed to investigate but are yet to publish a response. The rebels have since 2017 been fighting for a breakaway English-speaking state from French-speaking majority Cameroon. The United Nations says clashes between the two sides have since left at least 3,300 people dead and more than 750,000 internally displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.